Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. My name is Jack Pelling, and with me, as always...
It's me, Robin Allender.
Hi, Robin, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm all right. In the interest of transparency, we're pre-recording this one, so it feels like, you know, it's only been a couple of days since our last show went out, so haven't got an enormous amount of updates, but
sure.
It's all good. Very much looking forward to...
I suppose it's like, you know, when people work with each other and you're like, oh, how are you... And you have to sort of start getting into the detail. I mean, we chatted last night. I mean, you know, it's like, what did you have for tea? That could be a good update.
I did. I made some pesto.
Yeah.
Because
you made it from scratch?
Yeah, so I had everything in the fridge for it, and I really wanted to use up all my pine nuts because they're so expensive. So, yeah, I made some homemade pesto, which I had for
pasta
and some chicken. It's very nice.
Good. We had a chili con carne that had been in the freezer for since about May. Is that bad? We're in October now.
That's fine. That's absolutely fine.
I mean, if I suddenly pass out in this podcast, you'll know the reason why. I think that's broadly fine, isn't it?
God, I mean, I think that's made me feel quite disgusting that you're even worried about that.
I thought 3 months was the limit.
Over lockdown, I ate a lot of chicken thighs that were definitely pre-Brexit.
Pre-Brexit chicken thighs. The glory days.
They were fine, though.
Yeah, right.
They tasted of, you know, before the world all went to shit.
Anyway, really good episode, this one, with Al Roberts. Who you may know from Stathlet's Flats and from the comedy troupe Sheeps. It was a really good chat.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was really good to get him on after Jono a couple of weeks ago. So we're two-thirds of the way through the Sheeps trio. And it was really funny. He very kindly listened to every single Beatles record back-to-back in preparation for the show.
Yeah.
Which was going above and beyond the call of duty. But it was really interesting, actually, because it's not something I've ever done, is listen to the whole back catalogue such quick succession.
We had a good chat. I really enjoyed that we were chatting about just learning to play some of the Beatles songs. And we had this... So this is to kind of like spoiler alert, but I raised the... suggestion, is Dear Prudence the only Beatles song that's in the guitar tuning of Drop D, which guitar players will know is the kind of classic folk and hard rock
and new
tuning.
Metal.
And of course it isn't the only song in Drop D, because I Want You, She's So Heavy is famously in Drop D. You want to get low down
only
on
one
that.
Of the guitars, though.
Only one. Well, yeah, yeah, interesting.
Well, yeah.
Called the bow, bow, bow.
Yeah, which is crazy because I couldn't remember any other ones. And then I literally just used to, when I was learning to play the guitar, like 12 or 13, I just used to play that over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, yeah. I only just learned how to play it this since learning that. And it's so hypnotic to play. I just want to...
Yeah.
There's a really good band called Kogumaza? K-O-G-U-M-A-Z-A, Kogumaza. But they used to end every gig by playing that riff on a loop for ages. But then I sort of was Googling it, and there's, you know, that website, The Beatles Bible?
There was a
thread on there about Beatles songs in Drop D, and someone pointed out, which is probably the most eagle-eared thing ever, that George Harrison is in Drop D for Act Naturally on Help. Because you can hear him like doing like nice lead stuff, and then he hits this low D. It's like, wow, how did he pick that up?
Crazy. I mean, it's not one I've ever felt the need to learn.
I like Act Naturally. It's good. I'm a defender of the Help album.
In John Lennon 80th News, there is an article in the Telegraph this week by a lovely man called Tom Gibbs, who is kind of exploring the life of Lennon sort of decade by decade. And he was kind enough to ask us for some opinions on that. So it's sprinkled with some little quotes from Robin and I. And it's a really good read. So and it's free to read. I think the Telegraph is usually behind the paywall. So you can go to that by just searching John Lennon 80th on Telegraph.
Yeah, it's great. He's put an awful lot of work into that. And there's a lot of kind of really interesting perspectives, because it's sort of, it's like looking at his life from when, you know, at the age of 10, 20, 30, and then obviously Lennon at 80, what his kind of legacy is.
It's a nice antidote to the usual sort of obit structure of well-worn Lennon obituaries. But yeah, check it out. So we won't keep you any longer. Let's get on with the show. Here is Al Roberts.
Well, that's a nice glass of water.
This is a gin and tonic here.
Nice.
Oh, I'm going crazy. What
a
setup.
Tuesday at 6:30. I thought, why not?
Well, we are joining you.
I've got a can of Stella.
A can of Stella and a gin and tonic.
Thank you so much for having me on. This is I've been looking forward to this for all week.
Oh, thanks so much for doing it. Yeah, we were glad when Jono mentioned that you were a big fan.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Jono knows his stuff, and in fact, everyone I've listened to really, really knows their stuff. But I've done my homework. I've listened to all the albums this week, starting at Please Me, going to Let It Be, finish Let It Be, you know, a couple of minutes ago.
Really?
So
have you actually? Yeah. Or are you...
What's that?
Have you actually done that?
Yeah.
Wow, brilliant!
Yeah, amazing.
You know, it was lovely because. You know, I listened to it mainly as a kid, and you know, obviously I feel I know all the songs, but you know, it was amazing to revisit everything in order. Yeah. I've never done that before.
So you listened to all the albums, and did you do the singles, Past Masters, and things like that as well?
Some of the ones I wanted to. I listened to Rain.
Sure.
You know, which is. I've never worked out why did they never want to put like something like Rain on an album? Like it would have really, you know, elevated. I mean, surely there was a place for that on Revolver or something. What was the thinking behind that? They were just churning it out at such a rate that they were just like,
yeah, I think it was just literally them trying to hit dates and EMI being like, we need a single for Shrove Tuesday. You need to get this out.
But I think as well, there wasn't this idea that thing it, just because it was going out as a single, it wouldn't necessarily have been kind of lost. I mean, this, you know what I mean? Like the singles were still listened to as much as the albums.
Yeah, I know. I guess that's the sort of more latter day thinking about like the album, you know. But they were churning out two a year. Like it didn't matter so much for them.
It's also a double A side in which. Like Rain is the B side is much better than Paperback Writer.
Yeah.
You should disagree.
Really?
Yeah, I love Paperback Writer. It's great.
It's good. Ringo's best drumming performance.
Paperback Writer's great, but Rain does something else. And was that the first time they did the sort of backward recording as well, or was that?
I think so.
They're sort of wandering around, where are they, Kew Gardens or somewhere, just looking cool.
Just chilling out. Yeah. And it's very, very heavily slowed down as well, isn't it, Rain? It sort of sounds very slow.
Yeah, it's a strange song. And I've tried so hard to work out what John's getting at there with. It's not actually raining. It's
a metaphor.
I've never quite felt that in my bones, to be honest, that lyric.
Yeah.
was there anything particular that jumped out at you listening to them in order then?
I kind of I'm conscious that absolutely everything has been said about every single, you know, it's so well and you know, it's such a short period of time, and I was even kind of working out when they had haircuts, you know, like it's such a short sort of period. So I'm aware that everything, you know, has been said, but I feel, for me, I've sort of the sort of Lennon McCartney axis. I sort of saw it from a different side in that they need each other. You know, obviously it's been said a lot of times for the songs, but it seems that John is needed in the beginning to drag them into something cooler. You know, I hadn't sort of realized that that sort of sad period that he had in Beatles for Sale, when the first three songs are absolutely not what anyone was asking for. Like, they're so sad, and you know, like this, we doesn't this need, is... you know, I'm a loser. Like, where, you know, and it felt like I don't think Paul would ever have, you know, dragged them into that slightly cooler terrain. But then you need, but then I also realize, you know, towards the end, I think you need Paul just to rein John in a little bit. Like, I think Let It Be, you need Let It Be on that album, you know, and you need a you know, you need Blackbird, and you know, I feel John would have just gone entirely into, you know, Revolution Number 9 on the White Album, and you know, he would have been 5 hours long kind of thing, and he still needs to do his melodies, and it sort of reins them in a little bit. I'd never sort of seen them needing each other in that sort of macro way. Whether that's you know, I mean, it's hard to put it, you know.
That is really interesting, the 64, 65, that's what John called his fat Elvis period, isn't it?
Even Help as well. Like, no one wants to hear that, like, as the first song track on the album, you know.
Really?
Wasn't it was their vibe.
The most overlooked and obvious cry for help.
Yeah, right.
It's got an exclamation mark in it, and yet people still were like, didn't realise he was struggling a bit. But I think, like, yeah, Plastic Ono Band, I always think is like what a Beatles record without the Paul's kind of levity would have sounded like. It's an absolutely amazing album, but it's a bit of a sort of slog. And, you know, it's nice to end with Your Majesty instead of a song called My Mummy's Dead. Which is the sort of comic respite on that record.
His
sense of humour, I think, is kind of, it's more sour, isn't it, than Paul's.
So I feel like we haven't really done, we just leapt right in. Right,
oh, yeah,
into
oh, yeah,
we haven't
sure.
really
no, was,
done
was
an introduction.
Ready to go.
Yeah.
I've
yeah, no, I like that.
Like, I was finishing
gin
that
and tonics.
drinking all day.
So, yeah, introducing to the podcast Mr. Al Roberts. Hello, Al.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
How are you? We'll go back to your Beatles Odyssey, but how are you doing? How's your lockdown been?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, that kind of April, May, June period is a real sort of mush. I can't really put a handle on it, you know, as to what exactly I was doing. Like, sometimes I remember, you know, looking out of the window and the sun being on my face, and
then the rain came.
And I finally knew what he meant.
Lost weekend.
Yeah, but for that period, I just kind of got through it, really. But yeah, I'm doing okay. It's nice. It's nice for things to be sort of getting back to some sort of normality, you know, for me. I realize that's not the case for a lot of people, but you know, filming has started on something, and
great.
I mean, like, I filmed something in July, and
is that a, like, George Harrison biopic, or is that something that you just can't tell us the title of?
I wish it was a George Harrison biopic. I don't know if I can, it's so annoying. I don't know. I feel so self-important not being able to reveal the title, but it's only because I'm worried that it'll sort of come out that it was me, you know, who's like number 18 on the call
the
sheet.
New Bond.
You know, revealing this thing. But I did do something in July with, you know, in the height of COVID filming, and it was so strange. You know, you turn up and you have to take all your clothes off, and they give you like a dressing gown, and you have to
Are you
hold
sure
like
this was
a panel.
The film set, was it?
yeah. You know, you have to hold a paddle in front of your face to stop the air, like, you know, and it was awful. It was the complete opposite of fun.
How do they do sort of makeup and stuff? Do they have a really long brush and stand at it?
God, just, you know, a really long brush would be good. I love that, yeah. So. No, it's just someone in a sort of hazmat suit, and genuinely, and it's only you and them in the room, and yeah, genuinely, you don't really see anyone, but they've sort of relaxed that a tiny bit, but yeah, sadly everyone's getting COVID. Robert Pattinson got COVID, and you know, if Batman can get COVID, then everyone's going to get it. So
yeah.
So, you know. Have you just inadvertently said what the project was?
I'm not in Batman, no. Right, okay. They haven't. They've been terrible. Yeah, they haven't found a place for me in the franchise. I've been all the meetings.
Young Alfred.
Have you been keeping busy with writing and other things like that?
Or it wasn't a productive time, I have to be honest with myself. I mean, no. I was coming up with absolutely nothing, and hindsight, the ideas, but no.
So let's go back to your album Odyssey. Over what period of time did you listen to the album?
Last Tuesday when I found out this was going to be Tuesday.
Wow. So you listened to all of them in the... Cool.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's hard sometimes because you know the song so well that sometimes, you know, it does just kind of... I've listened to three songs and not sort of, you know, really, really listened. And that happened quite a bit, especially with the Beatles kind of washed over me slightly. It just kind of came and went. I've given it a good crack. And
Did you skip anything?
Did you listen to Yellow Submarine, the Yellow Submarine album?
I didn't do Yellow. No, I skipped. Yeah, that's one for the real completists. I listened to what's it called, Northern Song, because I was just sort of curious. What the hell is that? You know. But yeah, no, I felt that there was too much overlap. I think I listened to. But yeah, some of the singles I haven't listened to Hey Jude. I think I pretty much covered everything. I'm not a huge fan of Abbey Road, and that kind of went pretty quick, especially, you know, when we're in the sort of operatic second half. That just, you know, really? I was doing the washing up, and that just...
You checked out for that point,
that
really?
Kind of came and went.
Why is that, do you think? Do you think you're more... What's your kind of period, then, that you like... Is it early? Or
I mean,
kind of
I guess it's. I guess it's the. I think probably my favorite bit is the middle. I think, you know, same as Jono there, the rubber soul and revolver axis, where you know, they still have the kind of discipline of the. It's sad that, and I know Jono mentioned this as well, the idea that when you're older, you sort of like some of the early stuff, because it's just like, well, you know, a bit of discipline here, please, boys. You know, we don't want to get too...
Let's not get too silly.
Yeah, silly. But that is a problem. That is an issue with Abbey Road, while the second side is great, I love it, you can see how in that side there are the seeds of prog, basically. And, you know, elaborate gatefold sleeves and kind of, you know, big live performances. That's kind of the seeds of it are there. So you kind of think, well, maybe they kind of were good to stop there, because what could have come next, you know?
My slightly overly critical take is just that, you know, the songs... Well, when I feel the songs couldn't have gone any further than they went, you know, like me, I don't want to single out Mean Mr. Mustard, but I have a feeling that, you know, I don't know how long that could have gone out. And the feeling that, you know, it was a sort of, let's just get this in some form kind of thing. But I mean, obviously that's taking something that was, you know, astonishing and being overly critical about it.
So I'm assuming that if that's your sort of cutoff, you don't have any time for anything sort of solo McCartney or...
No, I'm not a solo McCartney, solo Lennon, and, you know, Harrison, I love all things must pass, but I haven't gone deep into it to be honest.
So what was your kind of what's your introduction to the Beatles? What's your kind of first memory?
I mean, it was all like, it was just one year, it was just year six for me. You know, I was coming home from school and watching, you know, we were lucky enough to have cable and to watch The Box, and Oasis were on this sort of like, you know, nine years old. That was the first time. It's just like that, you know, I want to be Liam. I want to be Noel. I want to wear those, you know, tiny little sunglasses that he wore. And, you know, I want to swear at the camera and stuff. And, and my dad, heard me kind of trying to listen to them and said that they were slime buckets. He really, you know, I don't think I'd have said that to it if, you know, if I had a 9-year-old boy.
Is that an exact quote?
Yeah. I mean, that's really stuck with me. You know, what is it? Yeah, 15 years on, or whatever. No, 20, 23 years on.
Nice.
And he said, you know, listen, you should listen to the Beatles. And I did, you know, a kind of obedient little boy.
Because that often doesn't work, does it? If your dad's saying, that's rubbish, you need to listen to this, that often kind of goes the other way, doesn't
it? Yeah, yeah. And I think it could have done. But I just kind of, despite myself, just found myself agreeing with him. It's an amazing thing to listen to as a kid. I guess because some of it is kind of, you know, child friendly, I guess. But it's just, there's just so much to explore.
So what was the record your dad gave you then to replace the slime bucket?
I don't remember. I'm trying to remember what order I listened to it in. I think Magical Mystery Tour was a way in because, you know, they're all dressed up and you've got, I'm the Walrus and all the sort of weird and wonderful stuff. I think that was the first one. And it's just that really exciting thing that you're just like, I have absolutely no idea what's going on here. I just did not. And that feeling is so kind of intoxicating. I just listened. And I think it was just a year of just listening to them all, you know, on repeat.
So do you think there's something in the Beatles' sort of psychedelic period or the more pastiche stuff that appeals to the comic sensibility and to kids as well?
Sort of realised re-listening to it, especially in the sort of psychedelic period, how much they're taking a sort of concept of Britain and lampooning it. You know, there's so much sort of old-fashioned stuff on, say, Sergeant Peppers, you know, and I don't really sort of register that at the time, in exactly the same way that the Python were doing. I guess there was a sort of angst about what it was to be British at that time.
And there's a lot of music hall, isn't there, in Sergeant Pepper? And I always think music hall is a kind of really interesting influence on so much art, you know, from, you know, T.S. Eliot to the Beatles, you know. But the music hall influence is kind of gone. As culturally, because, you know, there's not really recordings of it in the way that there are recordings of 50s, 60s music. So it's hard for us to realise what was being parodied, you know, with some kind of Beatles stuff, you know.
I don't even know if it's sort of parody, though, because it seems much more kind of affectionate.
It's like the Kinks, isn't it? It's more like a kind of, it's an influence, isn't it? It's an influence on the Kinks. You can hear musical elements in some certain Kinks and Beatles songs.
I guess maybe it was a sort of, you're always looking for something like a sort of countervailing, it was a nice balance to what they were doing. I think maybe they found it quite funny, you know, the idea of, you know, with the psychedelia, which was so, I guess, at the time out there, you know, there was a nice sort of countervailing contrast that they incorporated at times with this sort of, you know, British or more sort of quaint thing. I don't know.
It's also quite a nice sort of counterpoint to sort of what bands with like the Stones were doing, who were, and what was going on in America, where people were looking back to their sort of musical heritage, which was like really raw, unbelievably cool, you know, bands covering Lead Belly and stuff. And then the sort of sardonic British version of that being like, well, if you're going to cover, you know, Jelly Roll Morton, we're going to do George Formby or whatever. Because that's our kind of, you know, our spearing your kind of parents' music and your... It's British musical heritage or whatever. Maybe it hasn't aged as well. But I can't really imagine the Stones doing a sort of, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do.
Extreme weirdness, I think, can really appeal to kids, certainly appeal to me. I mean, I love that. I watched, for some reason, we had the videotape of Magical Mystery Tour, and I was just absolutely and that, you know, I mean, the song Blue Jay Way and the video that they did of Blue Jay Way is deeply disturbing. It's very strange. There's a real sort of menace to it.
I always loved Blue Jay Way as a
kid. I think any, you know, as you say, any sort of breach of authority or you know, some.
But I think that's the thing. I mean, that's it. I remember that as a kid being so. I just used to find nonsense so funny. I used to find surreal wordplay so funny. So the Beatles are part of that, and obviously Python's part of that. But
Well, that's such a Lennon-y thing. I mean, lots of Larkin and Lewis Carroll and all of those things that he was sort of obsessed with, very much in his sort of more playful side, which didn't last for that long. No, but definitely as a kid. Although I definitely did find it quite scary at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe how scary a day in the life is. I mean, that I honestly don't think I've listened to that properly since I was a kid, and that little bit at the end is so freaky.
Like, right.
And there's something about the chords. It's really, really, really troubling. But I loved it, and you know, I even remember, you know, like just trying intentionally, a sort of long Sunday afternoon, intentionally trying to freak myself out by, you know, turning it up really loud and just giving myself spooky thoughts and seeing if I could stay in the same room as the music.
Do you mean at the final chord or the locked groove at the end?
That final. Final chord, and then the sort of bonus little whatever it is at the end there.
Yeah, that is definitely not nice. I remember watching
nice thing.
Watching. So I was probably about 10 or 11, so I was already quite into the Beatles from my parents' record and having the Past Masters CD. And then I knew the sort of iconography of the Yellow Submarine film, but I'd never actually watched it. I remember being really excited to watch it on Boxing Day. And it was absolutely fucking horrendous.
Really? Were you spooked?
I was so scared of it. Right. It was awful. Absolutely terrifying.
I used to find Fool on the Hill very eerie.
I was playing that on the piano. It's it sounds like quite a sweet song, but what happens with the chords is so odd. Like the verse is in D major and then the chorus is in D minor, which I can't think of many songs that do that. It sounds like a sweet little melody, but there's so much weird stuff going on.
Yeah, I find that eerie. And what I was going to mention,
great sort of musical alliteration from Paul McCartney and the way it sort of goes up the hill and down the hill is pretty 101 stuff. But it's he's trying to achieve there. Also has recorders on it, which are terrifying.
Yeah, there's a sort of slightly folk horror-y vibe about a recorder, isn't there?
Did you play the recorder at school?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is. Music lessons.
Yeah. Oh, nostalgic. Memory. Yeah, instant nostalgia.
And what I really hated as well, which I'd completely forgot about this song, was when John sort of refers to all of these songs in Glass Onion.
Yeah.
As if there's some logic going on that you've kind of missed. And as a kid, I think you kind of hate that.
Yeah.
That really freaked me out.
That is a kind of unnerving song, isn't it?
It's great, though. Yeah, it is very strange. I don't know what effect he's trying to achieve.
Yeah. Well, I think he liked the kind of teasing people with clues and kind of...
clues for what?
Yeah.
What are you supposed to be trying to work out here?
Yeah. You're saying, Jack, you don't like the song Magical Mystery Tour, do you?
I don't remember saying that. Oh, is that on record somewhere?
I don't know, maybe.
I quite like it. It's not one of my favourites. I always think of it as being a sort of like poor version of Sergeant Pepper.
But isn't the end amazing, where the little piano thing is sort of very odd? Doodle-doo.
Yes, that is. Yeah,
that's beautiful. And it's just like 5 seconds or something. It's like, that's really eerie as well.
He always plays it live, and it always gets quite a sort of muted reception.
Really?
He plays it like he's sort of expecting it to sort of kick off.
Booze.
That's Paul's, is it?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he was... I also didn't realise he was doing a lot of the legwork in that period, right? I didn't realise
the walrus
was
Paul,
kind of idea, you know.
Yeah, I think it was just after the sort of death of Brian Epstein, and he was just trying to come up with all these kind of mad high concept ideas to get the others to sort of do something.
Yeah.
And then, that one was obviously a bit of a failure.
There's a nice bit in the Jem Roberts book. We interviewed Jem Roberts about this, the book he's written about the Beatles and comedy, where he was coming up with Magical Mystery Tour and he just wrote on a notepad and it was like, the bus needs to be yellow. And like that, I mean, that is pretty much all they had for the film, really. But it was like, it was just this kind of vague ideas.
Well, they've already, already had another sort of transportation device painted yellow. I mean, that idea was not new for them.
Not new, yeah. What about if it's a bus? Did you notice that when you were listening through to the albums, the kind of the influence of McCartney becoming more and more prominent?
Certainly with the in that period. I mean, it's funny sort of how they take it in turns to be the creative drive on particular albums. I think my main thing that I noticed was quite how, you know, if Paul wasn't there for those later albums, I don't think that they'd be half as good, which is something that I never really credited Paul for. You know, I presume that, you know, I guess I had this sort of mean idea that he was kind of always trying to, that he was slightly letting the side down in the psychedelic period, which is absolutely not the case at all. He was, and he was being so collaborative, you know, that even when you hear him in the backing vocal, somehow he sounds even more collaborative than John does. He's always he's always trying to sort of help the others realize their visions, I think.
Yeah.
I think his sort of more experimental side is something he gets a bit more credit for these days, because it was, he was into that stuff, weirdly, as the one who wasn't really the acid head, was the one who instigated a lot of the kind of psychedelic elements of albums like Sgt. Pepper, because the irony being that John was too fucked on acid to actually do anything.
Yeah.
So,
I love that he came up with the beat of Tomorrow Never Knows, didn't he, famously?
Did he?
Yeah.
That's an astonishing song. Again, it's been so long since I've heard that. I couldn't believe that. I mean, it sounds like the Chemical Brothers circa 96 or something. have either of you read the Tibetan Book of the Dead? Because I know that...
No, not really, no. Have you read it?
I've bought it and I've never read it. It's been sitting on my shelf.
Oh, really?
I
read the
years.
First 100 pages because that's where John got the idea for those lyrics, allegedly. Yeah. And I think Tom York talks about it as well, and all these people. I really, I mean, you know, I guess what you'd expect from an ancient religious text, but I couldn't find a way in. And
it's a real,
I mean, the first 100 pages, as I recall, is, you know, all the gods that you meet when you die, and, you know, advice on how to sort of look them. You always have to keep looking at them in the eye. But, you know, it's dense stuff, and I haven't sort of broken through to find what it is that's inspired so many people.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah.
Well, you shouldn't pick an argument with a dead man, but I would wager quite a lot of money that John Lennon never read the whole thing.
Yeah. He got the gist.
He wasn't one to follow through on these things.
But, I mean, Lord of the Rings was another huge hippie text, wasn't it? And, you know, the whole thing about the Beatles were going to do a Lord of the Rings film. And John thinks that he got really excited about it and sent it to... sent it to Stanley Kubrick, didn't he?
Stanley Kubrick.
And then like the next day he said, she couldn't be bothered to read it. He like probably read, you know.
Yeah, I think read a bit of The Hobbit. A good thing.
Imagine if Tomorrow Never Knows had been about set in the Shire, if that had been the.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Led Zeppelin / Tolkien material is quite a tough listen.
Yeah.
So, do you like that sort of.
Yeah, I don't mind.
Folky
type
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, not for me.
But it depends what gets kind of. I mean, Tibetan Book of the Dead still sounds cool, like if Tom York's still going on about it. Whereas if you said you were doing a concept album about Lord of the Rings now, yeah. I don't think many people would think you're cool.
No, probably not. No. I think they've mined all of the gold out of the, yeah. the main Tolkien text by
yeah,
now.
Yeah. You're a musician as well yourself.
No, I'm not. No, okay. I can sort of I have fun working out songs on the piano for my own amusement. And I think I have a pretty good musical ear. And I was always sort of so angry at myself for never learning music. You know, why did you not sort of put the time in to do that? And so I tried over lockdown to sort of, you know, learn how to read music, and even the first hour, I was like, no, this is never, ever, ever going to happen. And it feels like there's a completely different mind at play with you know, the writing it down to the sort of the hearing and the you know.
I always think it's a really sort of patronizing thing where Paul McCartney gets praised by the sort of, you know, traditional music community where they're like, he can't even read music, but yeah. He's still a kind of genius. You don't need to read music. Mm. I don't, you know. Mm. Obviously, it's helpful if you want to do certain things, but there's something so sort of fusty and, you know, snobbish about the obsession of being able to sort of, you know, write in the tenor clef. Or,
yeah. And also, know. Like, some of the Beatles stuff is so rhythmically strange. Like, I was playing Long to Across the Universe the other day, and... you know, there's this weird, like, bar of 5/4, and then it does a bar of 2/4. And I wonder how that was. Lennon explained that to the band. Do you think he was saying, "Okay, there's a bar of 5 here," or do you think he just said, "Okay, this goes like this"?
Do you think they just kind of worked it out? Or
yeah, because they often like so.
You don't really hear them talking like that much in the studio. George Harrison a little bit more because he liked because the Indian rhythms were so sort of important to him.
But yeah.
I think if you think about those really unorthodox things that start to come out in the sort of Help, Rubber Soul-y era,
yeah.
I think that's just him sort of adapting a 4/4 rhythm to the rhythms of his kind of speech and melody. And I don't, because some of them are actually, even if you were to annotate them now in terms of, I mean, this is quite boring, but...
No.
And, you know, from a... You know, I did sort of orchestration and composition at uni and stuff. So you're always... You know that if someone is writing a bar of 7/8, that they know that they're writing it in 7/8, whereas actually... Yeah. A lot of it is very sort of rhythmically ambiguous.
Yeah, and I think with Lennon, there's never any sense that he's kind of like, I'm doing this to be in 5 just for the hell of it. It's always just kind of an emotional instinct where the melody needs to be to cover these beats.
Well, I think it is a little bit, I think it is quite conscious. I think a lot of it is, well, why can't I have this many beats in here?
Yeah.
And then trying that, and, you know, he loved messing around and breaking rules, and that's, you know, that's where his, like, sort of innovative kind of stuff.
That's a great, I remember reading, listening to a great interview with the drummer from Mastodon. He doesn't read music. He always just learns. I mean, and Mastodon songs are incredibly complicated, but he always learns just by the feel and muscle memory and stuff. I mean, I'm sure he understands, like, time signatures, but he wouldn't say, oh, this is a bar of 9 and a bar of 7, and, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's much more emotional than that.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And if you listen to sort of Paul McCartney's more, like, his Liverpool Oratorio, which is a sort of classical big choral piece that he has written by sort of just, no, you know, singing lines to someone who's writing them
really
down.
that's
you listen
how he did
to
it.
Them.
Wow.
Yeah, and all of those rules that you study of, you know, the usual traps that even the sort of Hans Zimmers or whatever will set classical composition teachers' minds on fire, you know, sort of parallel fifths and things that are all, you know, your band from using. He never falls into any of those traps, because what he's doing is just music. The melody and harmony makes sense in his head from what he sort of picked up from this huge range of influences.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah,
and it makes sense to him, so he doesn't need to know the rules. He just instinctively knows them, which is what's so impressive about him.
McCartney is strikes me as he's such a strange guy. I think, like, on that very first track, I saw her standing there. Like, it almost feels like he's playing a role a tiny bit. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it feels like he's playing the role of the rock star musician to me. I found it very difficult. Like, Lennon, I feel I know what makes him tick. Like, you know, there's a lot of id in there, but McCartney, something about him, there's something very mysterious. He seems almost kind of timeless. What do you think it is that drives him?
I think a lot of songs like that are him trying to write like a classic very consciously.
Yeah, he always sings it as if it's a classic, as if the song is 100 years old, even if he wrote it like 3 days before. Like,
I think there's a lot of that, and a lot of like, today I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a song in this style, or I'm going to write a song influenced by this, or, you know, the way he talks about Jenny Wren is so sort of calculated. It's like, yeah, I wanted to write a song in the finger picking style of Blackbird.
Yeah,
about another bird. I'm gonna do one of my finger picky bird songs.
But he said that the other day about that. What's that song called on a recent album? Brazilian Girl, is it? I think it's called Back in Brazil. There lives a girl, dreams of the future and a far, far better world. But yeah, I saw an interview where he's talking about that song. He said, you know, I just felt like writing a song.
It's like you back in the USSR, but it's in Brazil.
There is that thing where it was work, you know, it was a bit of business. But he was able to do that, and they would also be amazing, you know. Like, let's do a song in this style, and it would also be fantastic, you know.
Right.
There's nothing that personal until the sort of end of the Beatles, really. I think probably Let It Be is his most sort of emotionally revealing song.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a lot of stuff on his solo record, but...
That's true, isn't it? There's a lot of stuff that's kind of masked in McCartney. Mm.
I think he's probably, the difference is he's someone who wants to write, whereas John Lennon's someone who needed to write.
That
doesn't sound too reductive.
I'm trying to think if there are any examples of him really sort of letting rip.
I mean, there's a lot, because we were talking with Jono the other day about Flaming Pie.
Oh, yeah.
And I went back to revisit Flaming Pie because the anniversary of remasters have just come out. And that's an album that he recorded when Linda had been diagnosed, and he knows that this is the last album that they're going to make together.
Yeah.
And when you sort of re-listen to it in that context and see the footage of them singing together... and singing harmonies on things like Beautiful Night, and Ringo's in the background and George Martin's doing the strings, and you look at him and he's just having the time of his life, but obviously he's completely aware that this is the last time he's going to be in the studio singing with his wife. Wow.
And if that was John, it would just be a song of him screaming.
Yeah.
You know, as mother is, you know, there was less filter for the emotion for John, maybe. Whereas with Paul, it's kind of filtered through pastiche or different styles.
Yeah, I do love it when one thing I really sort of like listening through it again was the tension, which I guess he kind of, you know, eventually does sort of go on to unleash his emotion, especially in Help and Onwards. But like, just seeing the footage of him in that, you know, in that suit that he's been asked to wear and that tie, and you can tell that, you know, that's not him at all. You know, as I say, like, there's this kind of animal energy to him. I mean, Paul feels, you know, he loves doing that, and he's in his element, and John's having a great time as well. But you can see, like, nah, that's not you. That's not you. You know, and I love him. You know, being the tension of him being forced into doing these kind of 3 minute songs.
I think anyone who's had to wear a school uniform
it does feel like that. Yeah.
I got a great, you know, you were talking about George being the kind of more maybe musically, technically proficient one. I heard this great fact the other day. This is going around on Twitter, but when George Harrison and Eric Clapton were competing for the hand of Patty Boyd, did you see this on Twitter?
No.
They turned up in a front room and did a 2-hour guitar cutting contest. Whoever had the hottest licks won her. Horrible.
Oh, God.
Oh, dear me.
I bet she just walked out of the room and just left them to it.
You would have thought they'd tried to record that at some point for perspective. Yeah.
So did you have a sort of favourite Beatle, or do you still have a favourite? I mean, it sounds like you're leaning towards a John kind of guy.
I love John. It's hard to pick a favorite, but we're talking about Tomorrow Never Knows and something like that, and I think, you know, Revolver is, I'd say, my favorite album, and the songs that he does on Revolver I always find breathtaking. I think I probably lean towards John a tiny bit more than Paul.
And we asked Jono the other day, I think you've heard the episode, but do you agree with his theory that if he had to attribute a Beatle characteristic to the Sheep's trio?
Oh, yeah. What did he say to that?
He said three Ringos. Which is also a fantastic name for a comedy trio, I think.
Yeah, the three Ringos, yeah.
Yeah.
But you're also going to be the Beatles of comedy at one point.
Yeah, I was pushing for the Beatles of comedy. I mean, we would have got into a lot of trouble very soon, I think. And also, no one wants to see that show. I think attendances would have been even lower than they were in the early days. I don't know. I think in terms of personality, I think I'm a sort of blend of George and Ringo. George and Ringo and Liam's John and Jono's Paul for sure.
Right.
I don't really know about writing style exactly. I think it's presumptuous to try and map our sketch writing onto the Beatles' songwriting ability. If I was forced to, that's probably what I'd go for.
And in terms of your sort of like comedy, do you have a Beatles of comedy or a comedy of
who's the
informative as the Beatles were?
I mean, the British Office was huge for me when I was 18, 19. But at uni, when I started getting into comedy properly, Tim and Eric it's exactly that same thing as with A Day in the Life. Like I just never heard, somebody sent me a sketch and I just looked at it and I didn't smile once, and I just didn't, what the fuck is going on? I had absolutely and it's the most wonderful feeling to just have no idea what on earth is going on, and then gradually after watching it sort of five times, you learn a whole new style of comedy or something. And so I was just obsessed with Tim especially. And I haven't rewatched it in a long time, but I have to be. I was having dreams about them every single night. I was sort of trying.
Yeah, to I mean, I remember watching that when it first came out. Awesome show, great job of it just being. I just couldn't believe the time that had been put into jokes that were just like. Were just kind of barely there, and that was the funny thing. Is like, I can't believe they did.
Eric once said in an interview that the laugh they were going for is a laugh that a fan told them that they had with the show, which is where they watched the show completely, no laughs at all. Then five days later, he was driving in a car and had to pull over because he was laughing so hard, remembering what was in that sketch. Like the absolute absurdity that some of this stuff, The deep pants for containing
and the songs
your diary
as well
and
were amazing.
Why have you exactly like? There's people are on a set filming this. Like, how dare you?
Yeah,
the time out of this world.
We always used to. Beaver Boys was such a big. do you remember the Beaver Boys? They're obsessed with drinking with shrimp and white wine.
Shrimp and white wine, which they say openly was just to try and make each other laugh in the writing room. There's no satirical point to that at all.
That's great. But then, Tim Heidecker has taken that to kind of extreme lengths, hasn't he? With the kind of the on cinema,
in cinema.
Have you seen that one where? It's that courtroom drama that he's.
Yeah,
he's done.
That's the kind of. I've got friends who are really deeply immersed in that universe. But the only things I kind of watched. It's one of those things where I feel like I'm not sure I have the time.
No. I'm never
going to. It's quite a daunting prospect.
And the joke. is the time you put into it.
Yeah, that's and presumably the time they put into it, because I've tried to work out how they did that, and they must have an actual trained judge. because it's all improvised.
Yeah, there were like legally trained people.
Yeah,
in the courtroom
yeah,
for that
and
one,
you know
yeah.
how exactly they got through that, and it's sort of what is it like eight? Well, yeah, something like yeah, it's hours and hours anyway, like yeah. maybe sort of 4 or 5 hours, and I'm not going to watch the whole thing. But I've never seen anything like it. It must have taken yeah. months to prepare. And again, like what you're finding yourself laughing at is just like, you know, reminding yourself yeah. that, you know, why is Tim wearing that suit? Like, you know, just.
I think when you go and see Neil Hamburger as well, and you, it's great to see people who are in the room who don't know who he is. And like I was for the sort of first time I saw him. And people get really angry.
Yeah, well,
and
you know.
That's such a funny reaction to see.
Yeah, and, you know, I can understand why. I mean, it's when you think of what Neil Hamburger's doing, I mean, it's the strangest joke. Like, he's sort of halfway between a parody of a sort of old school entertainer, and then you're actually laughing at the jokes themselves as well. And it's a very specific thing asked of the audience.
Have you heard Tim Heidecker's new album?
No. I like the fact that he's into sort of kind of a very specific type of breezy, you know, guitar pop, I guess. No.
It's good, and it's like I think, but it's curious because it does come back to the Beatles, because there is all that. With Tim Heidecker, there is that kind of weird balance between sincerity and absurdity, in which is the Beatles had as well, which is like, how can Tim Heidecker, who's written a song called Diarrhea, write a serious like kind of country rock album, and you know, there you have it, he has done.
He's a big Beatles fan as well.
I'm not surprised.
Were you ever kind of in bands when you were growing up then? What were your musical tastes when you were a teenager, you know?
No, I always sort of vaguely tried to get it happening, and vaguely sort of on the outskirts of conversations, you know, and people said that they'd get back to me and stuff. Yeah. I'm glad. I don't need any more embarrassment from my teenage years. I haven't got a shadow of a doubt that it would have been appalling.
Right.
What I'd have done. I sort of wrote songs and recorded myself playing these songs. And if any of these recordings are ever found, you know, that would be just so embarrassing, so self-important, and you know,
that's just writing songs though. You just need to get over that.
That never changes.
So after getting into the Beatles kind of around age 10, what were you listening to after that?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, what you'd expect, you know, a guy. I mean, it was just the indie I guess what was then known as those indie stuff, you know. Radiohead next when I was 13, and then, you know, all the re-exploring the 60s and the 70s with the Rolling Stones and Nick Drake, and then sometimes weirder with sort of Captain Beefheart and you know, ticking what you'd imagine to be the boxes.
You're so self-deprecating. You're just talking about like, sorry, I'm so boring, and I like amazing music.
And I've really lost. I should remind myself that it's okay. I guess I attach it too closely to the, you know, to who I was, you know, and
right.
sort of, yeah. you know, the sort of self obsession and self importance of being a teenager. I find it hard.
I was buying Grace kind of defies that.
That meant a lot to me when I was 18. Yeah. You know?
Of course it did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder what it is about that record that everyone was obsessed with it when they were sort of 16, 17, 18.
Yeah.
And then no one listens to it anymore.
Well, I think they do. And I don't know.
Do people? When was the last time you whacked on Mojo Pin?
Well, I'll tell you what. Mojo Pin's great. Dream Brothers is great.
But I wouldn't even consider, considering all of those bands that you just mentioned still mean everything to me. There's something about Grace that seems to be, in the same way that people have a John Lennon phase around. Probably a little bit earlier than that, but there's something about that record that obviously really hits home with, like,
well, the thing is, I remember the first time I heard it, I thought, like, oh, this is a bit cheesy, isn't it? It sounds like Sting. And then, like, and then I got into the fact, oh, like, he's got an amazing voice, and like, you know, the songs are kind of, yeah, it's very well written. It's
lashings,
very polished.
Tragedy, which always annoys.
Yeah, yeah, and the tragic story of it. And then now looking back at it, I sort of think it's cheesy again.
Yeah,
I don't know what kind of came.
The production
full circle.
Really doesn't help. And
yeah, it's very 90s, but I do think I think it still stands up. I mean, it's one of those things where it's been overdone and overplayed, isn't it? And it's become a kind of. I mean, obviously, but I mean, he was undeniably incredible. But like, I mean, there is isn't there there's a video of him playing, and I think he's playing, So Real or something, or maybe it's I can't remember. It's one of the songs of Grace, and he introduces it, and he says something like, "This is a song about lust," or like that, and it's like, it's a bit like,
yeah,
come
I don't
on,
have
mate.
Much time for that.
Yeah, I'm misquoting
him. Come back, it'll come full circle. You'll have time for that. I can imagine being 48 and sort of seeing that.
Yeah. Hey, it's Robin here. Just wanted to clear up this whole Jeff Buckley thing. I love Jeff Buckley. I think he was brilliant. He's a genius. You know, he's fantastic. You know, all that shit. A genius, man of genius. But, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And I think all I was trying to say with this Al Roberts thing was that sometimes, you know, I find him a bit cringe. Like, so the actual bit I said, he doesn't actually say this is a song about lust. He says, this is a cautionary tale. And, you know, that is a little bit cringe, isn't it? But still, I love the guy. I think he's fantastic.
This is a cautionary tale.
Okay, so I hope that clears that up. Thanks very much.
I remember, distinctly my friend saying, so it's so real, but it also sounds like surreal. And that completely blew my mind. Yeah, and, I had to take the hour off after that. That was enormous.
Yeah. And so, how did you get into the comedy world? Was that at uni with meeting?
Yeah, that was at. I sort of wanted to do acting mainly, and then realized I was probably funnier than. As a sort of dramatic, so I sort of moved towards that.
Right.
It all happened quite quickly. I guess especially at that age when you sort of find something and you realize that that's your thing, then you just I just became obsessed. Tried to do as much as I could.
Is there another series of stuff coming out? You had an excellent evening at the BAFTAs the other day.
Yeah, it looks pretty good, but we don't know. I mean, I think COVID is kind of, a lot of channels are sort of having a long old look at what they're doing. Mm. But hopefully, I mean, we'd absolutely love to do another one.
How much of your character is in the character and staff? Is it improvised? Is any of it improvised?
No, Jamie. It feels like it's improvised, but everything. I was saying the other day, like, you know, down to like the weirdest sort of thing, you see it on a piece of paper and it doesn't make any sense. I mean, Jamie wrote a line for himself on the script. It's fresh out of ... then the letter B, then ... dice. And it's like, I mean, that is very hard for anyone else coming in to deliver that line.
Yeah.
It's actually the very little improv at all. It just feels like it's improvised because, how Jamie writes it.
That's amazing.
I love the bit where he comes in and he says, you look like James Bond, and he holds a gun to your head and goes, crack.
It's so weird. But yeah, I mean, he takes so well. He takes so long on these little details because the crap.
Yeah,
for some reason,
well, I think that's like,
sounds funnier than whatever alternatives there
are. Yeah, that's really fascinating because I mean that is the problem with Magical Mystery Tour is that they thought they could just go on to this set and improvise and be really funny. You know what I mean?
And yeah, like, they're not. Mm. Yeah, well, John, I think always, you know, in my opinion, always thought he was slightly funnier than he was. But having said that, I mean, you know, I think it was around Hard Day's Night. Sort of time, and they did that thing where they did Midsummer Night's Dream. I don't know if an American thing.
They're so good
at acting. Like I don't know if it's just like a confidence thing. You know, they're sort of riding so high, but it's just like you'd hire. Yeah. I mean, maybe not Ringo, but you'd hire the other three on the spot. It's kind of like
They had this, you know, strange sense of invincibility when they were right at the peak.
Yeah,
where you could tell they could just do anything, and I think a lot of the problems with Magical Mystery Store is that the milk had started to turn a bit sour by then. And they lost a bit of confidence in losing Brian Epstein and stuff.
But, oh, really?
Well, at the Cavern, when they did gigs, they would do skits and they would, you know, banter with the audience. It was kind of quite comedy heavy, you know.
Well, John used to come out with a toilet seat around his head and piss himself.
In Hamburg, yeah.
So I'm not sure how funny that is.
Yeah, having listened to it, to Let It Be again, like, was it 3 hours ago? I think a few too many John jokes in there. There are about seven, and I can't understand, you know, what any of them mean. I don't even know the words to that first thing he says at the very beginning of the album.
I Dig a Pygmy by Charles Hawtrey and the Deaf Aids.
Yeah, I mean, Deaf Aids, I'm going to need some help with.
it's very goony, isn't it? Sort of Peter Sellers-y trying to sort of muscle in on that sort of thing.
But the songs are funny, I think. Like, yeah. You know, the song, I mean, I love that George Harrison won Piggies on the White Album. Like
was it Jono saying he liked Piggies as well?
It might well have been.
With the sort of harpsichord or clavichord and the pig sound effect. So again, you know, it's that sort of thing. It didn't need to exist. Like, you know, it's very entertaining.
We'll just ask you our stock question, and then we'll let you go because we catch you for a while. But Al, do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. It's not technically Beatles, but I wanted to get on record how little I like the song Imagine. I'm not a fan. It doesn't do any of that sort of twist. You know, the melody, I think, is just a bit kind of facile. It doesn't have that sort of twisty sort of torsion that, you know, a lot of good Beatles songs have. The piano is kind of, you know, just sort of soupy and... and the lyrics.
It's a strange one to be so iconic, I think.
Yeah, I thought that lockdown thing of Gal Gadot and, you know, all the stars. I thought that was it in its purest form. I felt that the song was exposed for what it is.
Have you ever heard that thing that came out recently, which was a single by Freddie Alf Lennon that he was John's dad, that was released in 1965?
No.
We'll play a clip of it here, and I'll play it to you.
Yeah, yeah. This is John's dad.
Oh, whoa, that is him. Oh, my God. That's Imagine.
It's in C major as well.
I'll pick up my story.
Is Imagine in C major?
Yeah.
Yep, yeah, same key, same tempo, same everything. Bizarre.
Wow.
Well, that doesn't make me think any more of the song if it's if he's copied
but
his
I
dad,
think it
the
maybe
most despicable
had...
thing he could do.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of his that period where he was him and his dad were saying pretty horrible things about each other. So it might have been a sort of quite sly little screw you.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But
I think Nigel Farage said that he hates Imagine.
So I'm in good company then.
Yeah, but when that kind of came out, there was loads of people on Twitter saying, "God, Nigel Farage, he can't get anything right, can he?" And I was sort of like, "Well, you know, broken clock and all that." And...
Yeah, yeah. He also loves Obladi Obladi.
Yeah, that's what he comes on to. What is it? Yeah, UKIP rally.
So that was the fantastic Al Roberts, a very entertaining conversation, and thank you to him for all the amazing preparation he put into it. Mm. It was fascinating, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I loved that. I like the way he talked about when his favourite era, he said the Rubber Soul Revolver Axis.
Yeah.
Such a great way to describe it.
It's the perfect way to describe it in a way.
Yeah, it was good. No, it was a really lovely chat. It was very, very nice to speak to him. And I like those kind of insights into the workings of Jamie Demetriou behind Stathlet's Flats as well. And that kind of, it did link in a weird way to Beatlesy stuff. But I thought that was really interesting that Jamie Demetriou plans meticulously the utter nonsense that is Stathlet's Flats, which is so interesting, you know, because that's kind of what, as I said, the Beatles could have done in Magical Mystery Tour a bit more. You know.
Yeah, it was brilliant. If for some bizarre reason you haven't seen Stathlet's Flats or any of the other stuff that we've mentioned, that's available on 4OD or All 4, or whatever it's called now, well worth finding out.
Yeah.
This is the point in the show where we usually plug next week's guest, but we don't actually know who it's going to be yet, so... Yeah, instead of pretending we've got some incredibly special mystery guest.
You're making it sound like we don't actually have it. We do have some, we just haven't made the decision.
We just don't know which one we're going to go.
We've got a lot in the rucksack of opportunity.
So we got a few more. I mean, in real life where we are now, we're about to talk to Josh Widdicombe, which is going to be fantastic. So that will be coming up later in the run.
Yeah.
And we got a few more in this series. So some amazing people to come. And if you want to support the show, you can go to personalbeatles.com/donate to make sure that we can keep doing these. And that's very much appreciated. And
yes,
as always,
thank you.
Massive thanks to everyone who has done that and continues to do so. At the point of recording, we've got one more Your Own Personal Beatles mug left. So if you would like that, get in touch.
Yep.
And if you want to share any of your personal Beatles stories with us, as always, you can contact me at jack@homespunsounds.com or you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact. So we'll be back next week with another special mystery guest. And until then, goodbye.
Keep it fresh.
Love it. Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.